There's an interview with Mrs. Davenport. Today is the 9th of May 2001, and the interviewer is Kate Flinsby.
So, would you like to tell me about when you first worked in a forest? How long ago was that?
Well, I first started in August 29, 1939, in the weaving department. Porritt's Brothers and Austin, as it was known at that time, had over 500 employees, which was divided into two sections. One was the woolen side and one the cotton side.
So were you wool side or cotton side yourself? Were you in the wool side?
I worked in the cotton side.
Oh, right.
I started work in the weaving shed as a reacher in.
Oh, right.
And that was on the old Lanky. The cotton side was divided into two sections. One was a filter cloth section where they wove and made filter cloths for industry. The other was the felt section, which made dryer felts for the paper industry. And that's right. On reaching in, it's where you put the yells, as they're called, and the hook. The man puts a hook through, and the reacher in puts the end on that hook, and he pulls it back in so that them then go into the loom. It's as I reached in, the gentleman that was in charge of those reaches in, if when you put the end on you missed the hook, careful you use shin pads, otherwise you got a kick on the shin, but I was only on that job for perhaps 2 weeks at the most, and then with the war starting, quite a number of the employees was in the territorials, because Richard Porritt was in the territorials, and he encouraged all the men within them to join the territorials, and so there was quite a lot of them in the territory, and they were called up, of course, right after the war, which left a lot of vacancies in some of the departments, so they transferred me then to the warehouse, and I worked in the warehouse then. I was a gentleman that measured me when I went in the warehouse and weighed me, and I was 4'6". I was 15 year old, and I weighed 72 pounds.
You were very small.
I was very small, very small. In fact, they wanted me to be a jockey once, so, you know, so small. I was very, very small. You know, I was so small. In fact, I did get a job once as a telegraph boy, and I couldn't reach the bag. You know how they are.
Yeah.
And so I worked in the warehouse then, in the what was known as the cotton warehouse, until I was called up in the Navy at 18 and a half.
So working in the warehouse, did it matter that you were small? Would you have to reach for things?
No, because basically you was employed stitching bales up, stenciling all the shipping instructions on some of the bales and that type of, and sweeping up.
Alright.
Don't just switch it up a minute.
So where did you send the cotton to when you said you stenciled on the shipping instructions? Where were things sent?
They used to go, a lot of it was involved in war, started to do with carcass, you know, things like that, and used that. I think a lot of the shipping stopped at that situation, because I remember that we had 33 felts there, to go to Norway, and they couldn't go. They were all stenciled and marked up, and then they stayed in that warehouse all of the war.
And they were held for what?
They called it paper machine clothing, but it was dryer felts for drying the paper.
Oh, right.
You know, I could delve into the situation of paper trade, you know. I learnt more of that in my later years, you know. A lot of the work, of course, was low, you know. They did filter cloths for sugar. Tate and Lyle and places like that, you know. And a lot of them were the filterisation through cloths. They did the filter cloths for that area, you know. And we had many amusing times that way. We had one chappy there, and they got him trying to lift himself up with two buckets, a foot in each bucket, you know. They used to send you to the they didn't send me, but they wanted one or two, send you to the where the boiler house was to bring a bucket of steam. Those are the type of things as I went on in the warehouse, and
it sounds quite dysfunctional.
The director, or the chairman of the directors at that time, was Mr. Roland Spencer. And when he came to the mill, somebody popped around through the door, and he'd see his car outside the office. And they had a sign which they used to imitate driving of a car. You know, Mr. Rollerbrook. And we had one chappy there, he popped his head out and seen the car there, came back, and he stood at the bottom of the warehouse, and when he turned around, Mr. Roland stood behind him. I always knew there was a silhouette. One of the, I suppose you might call it frightening, but one of the things that used to happen in the mill at Christmas time, it was all the ladies of the different departments used to gang together, and they'd come through each hall swooping in each department to give you a kiss. Not that they had any mistletoe or that, but supposed to kiss you on the mistletoe, and if you got caught, you had to pay a shilling towards, and that went towards their Christmas spree. But at the same time, you return when it was the spree, they always make sure, if you paid, you got some eat or a drink back at the spree. But that's how they. But it was a bit rough, like you might say.
The sprees were a bit rough,
weren't they? Well, everybody used to scatter all over the place, up on the gantries and on the racks and anywhere out in the toilets. There was, like, smoking was a forbidden thing, but the people used to sneak in the toilet. This was all, you know, before the war, well, not the early part of the war.
Yeah.
It was during the Battle of Britain. There was one gentleman there used to run a sweep every day. Only copper. And then the planes would be shot down. And they used to give so much to the charity out. You know, he used to run this sweep and every day, and then was guest the number won the prize that were on offer. He did that for quite a long while. Again, I can't put names to him, but
So what did they do for their Christmas spree? When you said about Christmas spree, what did they do for that?
Pardon?
What did they do for their Christmas spree?
Well, it basically was the when it was the day Christmas Eve, which they shut down normally on the Christmas Eve, that afternoon, that day basically, there was very little work done, and they used to clear an area, and they'd have somebody to cater, they'd have, you know, meat pies, they'd have drink, there'd be music, a bit of dancing, and, you know, a general party atmosphere, you know, they'd have hats and decorated the places with all that decoration.
Oh, right.
There are one or two photographs somewhere. Some people will have some photographs somewhere of different departments, because I know I have seen them.
Did everybody go to that?
Well, each department, each room had its own spray.
Right.
You know, like in the warehouse, there was what was the cotton felters.
Mm.
They were all ladies.
Oh.
And what they did, basically, was to get two ends of a felt and joint together.
Oh, yeah.
Used to play havoc with their hands until their hands got used to them. That's basically what the lady did. They'd made them endless then, you see.
Oh, right.
And they had an endless thing situation. I worked, as I say, as a warehouse boy, warehouse lad. And then I went from there, they had a plating machine, I went on to the plating machine. Then I'd grown a bit bigger. And then when I was 18, of course 18, short of 18 and a half, I was called up in the Navy.
Mm.
By which time I got to 5'2" and I weighed 101 pounds.
You have progressed then. So when you said you were plating, what were you plating?
Well, they were the cloth coming off the loom was perhaps maybe 100 yards long.
Right.
So you thread it through this machine and it plated it into a parcel, and then you took that up, parcelled it up, and that were ready to be going to its wrapper to, or going to stock, whichever way
right.
you used it. You know, there were different jobs in the warehouse, you know, the big cylinders in there which used to stretch and dry the felts, you know, they used to do that in there too. And there was the sewing, there was also a sewing department.
So how many people worked there, do you think?
In the warehouse itself, or in the whole, as I say, within the whole mill, there was probably somewhere around, when I first 500, but when the war started and part of the woolen side closed down. There was not a lot of work. They used to make blankets and things like that. Beside the wet, what they call wet felts, they used to do the wet felts for the paper sheets. And a lot of those departments were closed down. And they used the rooms. The war, they stored sugar, corned beef, things like that, all black government stuff, and they used up the rooms for storing these different foodstuffs, really, used there and there. And then Stebbins, there was a landmine dropped in Stebbins. In fact, there was two.
Really?
And a lot of the windows in the mill were shattered. Well, if you did no weaving shed, one part of it was all glass panes. Slates one side, used to call them northern lights, I think, but they were light, they sort of let the light in. The more light they got in, the less electric they had to use.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of those were shattered. So some of the houses in Stubbins was also shattered. So they used two of the departments within the mill to store the furniture. They brought all the furniture from the houses in Stubbins and stored it all in the mill until such times as these people's homes were ready or they got alternative accommodation. That was another thing that happened through the war. And then they had a little plant thing which you put the cloth through, which put creosote on. So they dug out all old stock cloth they had and run it through this creosote implant and then covered all the windows with this. Until such times they could get the glass back in so they could keep the mill working, you know, because some of the glass had dropped right through onto the looms and cut through some of the warps and things. But you know, it was
Was anybody working at the time?
No, no, they didn't have a night shift then. They didn't have a night shift then. They shut down at 10. They used to have 2 shifts, 6 to 2 and 2 to 10, and they didn't have a night shift. And I know I was involved. We worked more hours than what should have done for that, for my age. You know, you were supposed to be limited, but there's extra money now. That was a bit bad. They weren't concerned. The blind eye, the war was on, and they had to be done. So that was another incident that happened when I was working in the warehouse. We used to have another chap there who was a dancer. He was a dancer. And he used to demonstrate dancing around the warehouse with a brush. Put him on the steps. He's still living, by the way.
So this is ballroom dancing.
Well, he's in his 80s now. Well, in his 80s. But he's still living. He used to dance around the warehouse with a brush. They did have, you know, they had a booker there too.
Oh yes.
A chappy had worked for the firm, but you knew where you could go and put your bets on.
Oh.
You know, which was common for a lot of people. Like in, there used to be quite a bit of, you know, certain.
Is that on horses people. Or football or what? On horses. What did you?
Horses. Horses. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Horses. He worked in the one department just next to the warehouse.
Right.
Everybody in the mill used to come and put the bets on there.
Did you win anything?
I didn't. I would never have. I mean, I'd have the odds, but I didn't. I mean, I was. I didn't have the money to put on horses. From what you got there, you know. 17. I started on 17 shilling and 11 pence per week.
At what age were you then?
I was 15.
Oh.
When the war, when the people got called up, the men got called up or went into the forces, the firm paid the married men wives £1 a week on their way there. And if you were single, your mother got 10 shillings. Now if you take that into consideration, that the average man's wage was about £2 a week.
Mm.
That was a half
his
wage. You know, in that month, it didn't go up, it stayed at a pound, even though the wages may have gone up. And then I was called up then.
So how long were you away for?
I went away in December 1942. And I came back in, I think it was end of May 1945, something like that.
Mm.
And I came back into the warehouse. By which time different people, new people had come in, like, and it's a matter of where were you going to fit in? Sort of thing, you know, was you down the ladder, up the ladder? They used to have what they call half crown foremen.
What's half crown?
There was usually in the warehouse you worked in pairs, two men. One of them was the charge man, so he got 2 and 6 a week more than the other, because he accepted, he did the booking in, he took the responsibility. So they used to call them half crown foremen. But there was quite a bit of that went on, you know. I came back, as I say, in 1945, and the wage then was, I thought, £4 something, £4.16, I think, £4.10, something like that was the wage then, which I had to get home. I'd been used to having about £3 a week spending money of the day, eh?
Oh, yeah.
So I had to come right to arrangements, so I can't get as much overtime, and of course the wages, as I say, the warehouse was probably the lower rate than the wages, because you needed like if you was what they call the big loom weaver, that was working from the record, that was an ideal job to be on. You made your own money, and you was well. You worked hard. You was well paid for it. You had a good wage from the big room, were you?
Were they paid by the hour?
But big loom weaver, if you were in the warehouse, you was paid by the hour. If you was a weaver, you was paid by footage of how many feet you wove.
Right.
And the quality, because if you had bad quality, you didn't get paid for mending it. You had to mend that so you wove as well as you could, because if you had to mend it, you didn't get paid for mending. But they was very good, some of the weavers, in the sense that he'd always save that little bit at the end of the week, so that when it come a short week, they never had a short week. You know what I mean? He came back, because he didn't get others who paid them in those days. There were no such things as others who paid them. So they used to hold so much back, and when they come to a short week, they brought that through, they'd make a full week.
Oh, right.
So they'd never had a short week, and
right.
You could do that in the big loom weaving. You know, it was, as I say, it was probably a, from the working side of it, was probably the best paid job.
Was that quite skilled? That was quite skilled, I presume.
Yeah, it was a reserved occupation, actually. They took some, but then it became, it was so essential that the paper mills kept going, and the paper mills, so it then became a reserved occupation, because it was hard to get the called big loom weavers, you know, so. And it was, of course, that time it was all cotton. See, everything was cotton, felt. When I came back after the war, I went back in the warehouse, and a lot more of the men came back too as had gone away, so it was a matter of fitting everybody into the jobs, and you sort of started down the bottom again, wondering which way you was going to go. And at the big loom weavers, I said, they was full up, they didn't want any. So the job they got was getting some new, what they call doubling machines. That was machines that doubled the yarns together, you could have. And these were classified as being too heavy. Ladies did it. But when they got these new machines, it was classified as being too heavy for them to do, because it meant putting big spools on top bases. So the manager came and asked me, would I be interested in going on that job, as it would be more money. So I said yes. So I was the first man on that job, as being taught doubling by the ladies taught. And then they brought these machines in, of course more and more men started, and automation came in, and work study. And of course, where you started off with one machine, got to two machines, got to three machines, where eventually each man had four machines to run, which was, and you worked as a steam, and you were on base rate, what they call base rate. And I did that for 20 years.
Right.
And that was on a three shift, sometimes two shifts, sometimes three shifts. 1951, I think it was, there was fifteen of us on three shifts. Five in the cotton industry, it always came up, the ups and downs. Five had to go.
Really?
So the last five, there was no redundancy payments, they just had to work a week's notice and then. That left us 10 on two shifts. And then it got a little bit worse. So five more had to go. So that just left five of us, and we worked days then for quite some time, like working days, and we were then industry built up again, and they brought a night shift back. So we worked on a basis of those that had stayed through that time, because we'd quite a lot of, we used to work 1 week on, 2 weeks off, 1 week on, 2 weeks on the dole. Those that stayed was then said, right, you stay on days, if we stay a night shift, they will work permanent nights.
Right.
So they had a permanent night shift.
Were they paid the same, or did they?
No, you've got, I just can't, you work 6 to 2, you got 8% on your wage. If you work 2 to 10, you got 12.5% on your wage. And if you work nights, you got, I think it was 30% on your wage. And they used to work 4 nights.
Right.
Start Monday night, and they finish Friday morning.
Mm.
They worked 4 nights, 12 hours, 40. That's how they worked. There's, had one or two amusing. We used to have a man in the boiler house who was who played the flute.
Mm.
Only on a Friday night. And he used to clean, every Friday night he used to clean what his boilers and flues and everything. He used to be right good clean. And then he'd have a bath. And we used to have our night break round about 2 o'clock in the morning, we'd have our break. And he used to come across with his flute. He played hymns. And we used to sit at this little place, well, he played the flute and we used to sing hymns. And the people that lived on each view, which was some houses across the road, complained. We were singing in the night with him. And we used to walk up and down the alleys with him up front playing. Oh, it was, you know, it was really funny. And another instance there where, again, not mentioning any names, but this chap here used to, he was very, very active. He used to run bingo, he used to run dances, he was involved in all things sort of salad. And many times it would be 1 o'clock in the morning when he'd get into bed. And he'd be on the 6 o'clock, 6 till 2. So he was up again at 5 o'clock. And he was a labourer for the warpers. And his, once he was straight, he'd just say, am I all right now? And maybe this would get about 9 or 10 o'clock in the morning. And then he'd into the toilets. There was a gap in the door, toilet door, but he used to put his foot against the door. And away, he'd have 40 winks. And the chap is there, so the one, I remember this particular thing. He's fast asleep. And this bloke he laboured for got a cob of tourmaline. Well, tourmaline doesn't blaze, it smoulders, you know, smoke. So he lit this and he got it all smoke. And then he just popped it under the toilet. And all that all little while. Well, you see, again, it was one of the. It did. There was, on the big looms, there was another chap, he was always. Everything was in a hurry, you know. On fire early, they used to say. And if it was time for him to brew, he'd come dashing down his loom and grab his pot and lock the big kettle to brew up. Well, it was one of these tin mugs. And they knocked a nail through it and nailed it. And he come out, bitten all the lot. There was characters there as they're not, you don't get them in the works today, like there isn't time. If it's to say, not a criticism of management, but the fact that because of the weird situation, there was a certain, well, let's not, you know, they might take more money, things like this. If they allow a little bit like the betting job, they knew they were going to stay. They turned a blind eye to check the workers.
Yeah.
You know, that was, and they turned a blind. Today, that wouldn't apply because you're on bonus systems, time thing, and it doesn't, you know, it doesn't apply. But it, some things they turn a blind eye. They used to have a bus ago, a horn used to go every, you were allowed 2 minutes from that horn going. Quarter an hour if you were over that. You got a quarter on top. Yeah, that was another, and the same going out, they were clock, you had to clock in, you see. But if you clocked out before time, it used to be 5:30 in days. Now you clocked out at 5:29, you lost a quarter of an hour. So, you know, they used to queue up, the clock waited for 5:30, and then everybody come out there at the lunch. But just turn it off a minute. And then I was in there 20 years, approximately.
The Dublin department.
In the Dublin department. Yeah. And then a vacancy come for assistant supervisor, assistant foreman, or a so I applied for this job. And after little discussion, they decided to give me the chance to take this, I'll go at this job. They'd give me on a 6 months trial working as an assistant, and if after the 6 months they wasn't happy, I could go back on the job, or I could finish whichever one. But that materialised in the sense that I'd only been on it 6 weeks when the foreman became ill, left me on the job. So, you know, the assistant of the manager, and I go up, I did the job. It was, oh, there was three departments. I coped and I did the job. And the chappie came back after 6 weeks and they said, oh, my 6 months, I didn't need to serve that, they'd accept me. I'm there. So again, I became assistant. That's my first step up the ladder, as you might,
right.
You might say, in there. And, and then, strangely enough, I hadn't been on that job only about 6 months when they came and asked me to go back into the warehouse as the foreman in the warehouse, supervisor in the warehouse. Say I'd been away from it for 20 odd years, you know, there was some difficulties which, but anyway, I went into there and I worked back in the warehouse as the supervisor then. But in the meantime, the old industry itself had changed from cotton and slowly but surely onto synthetics. So at the end of the 20 years Dublin, probably 80% was synthetic, all synthetic. And they made, and then from what we called the dry end of a paper machine, making the dry felts, and we went over to making what we call the wet end wires, the wires of the wet end of the paper machine.
What does that mean?
Well, when you, I usually describe it, when you were making paper and it was pulped and everything like that and went through, when it came out onto the paper machine, 80% of it was water. And this wire, wet end wire, was a circular, ran along, it dropped on the wire, and as it carried along, all the water dried out, drained out, By the time it got to the dry end, there was just a thin film that went round the dries and became paper. That's the, and it was known as wet end wires, you know. And we've slowly but surely changed from the dry, mind you. We've then been taken over, of course, which was then, it was Porritt Brothers and Austin. Then it was Porritt and Spencer. Then it was Scapa Porritt. Then it changed the uniform, I think it was. To its present name, no, I don't know what it was under. But it changed its name and changed its process as well. The I probably should go back a bit in the sense that the filter cloth section was taken from Stubbins. They built a factory at Broadway, Elmshore, and all the filter cloth section was moved to there. They then took the spinning on the woolen spinning, what they known as the woolen spinning, was mostly synthetics, and they moved them from Stubbins to a new factory at Mossfield at Bury. That just left them the wet end wire section at Stubbins. The Blackburn, which was part of the Scapa Group, they took over all the dryers and we did the wet mill. The mill, part of the mill, then became empty, and that rented to TNT. They have, but that was what the woolen side was basically. They have, they did three extensions to the mill while I were there. So, and that's, and then I went from the warehouse. I still had the warehouse, but they asked me to take over the two other departments, so I had all the finish, what they call the finishing end, from the when it left the loom until it went out through the door, was what I was responsible for initially. That's what I was responsible for initially. And like they were like a supervisor in the warehouse, seaming, and the supervisor in each place, and I linked all the three departments together, which then was another step up the ladder, then became finishing manager, and then became a finishing manager.
Is that what you were when you retired?
Well, just, I didn't have until 2 years prior to my retirement, and they bought a factory in Livingston, that's in Scotland, which proved to be a little bit of a failure. So I went up there along with two or three others and to basically close that factory down, you know, work it out, close it down, and transfer whatever work was there back to Stubbins, because their quality standards didn't reach our standards, and there, so that I went up there to Scotland every week, travelled every Monday, came back on the Friday until the place was empty, and then I came back, and I used to go out to different paper mills up and down the country if they had a problem. I developed a way where I could get what they call creases out of the wires without taking off machines, and if they had one, I'd go and move it or do little jobs, and sometimes they'd take ladies out to the machines and they'd mend the holes, little old came and they'd mend the hole and things like that. Jobs like that, and stock control, and I did that. I was working with the production director then, like I was responsible, I worked with him, and they gave me a title of assistant to the production director. That was you could just turn.
Tell me what's the wires are.
What the wires are.
What are they?
What's known as the wires is a simple as I can, it's a conveyor belt for a paper machine. They call it machine clothing. And it takes, gets the pulp and carries it along when all the water drains out and takes it to the dry end of the machine, which eventually comes out as paper.
And how wide were these things? How wide were they?
How wide? The width varied. For a paper machine, probably 2 metres, probably one of the smallest ones, 2 metres wide. You'd go up to, I think it was 6 metres wide.
Why? And how much were they worth?
Well, dependent on the size of the machine, you know, that you start at the £6,000 or £7,000 for a smaller one, but again you go up to £50,000-£60,000 for the larger one.
And how long were they running continuous?
Well, yeah, if I can try and give you an instance of a paper mill Perfleet, Thames Board Perfleet, prior to them making these wires out of synthetic, it was made from phosphor bronze.
Really?
Phosphor bronze wires. And they used to be welded on paper machine, welded together on the paper machine. They would last, if they was lucky, to look at the 12 week if they were lucky.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. The synthetic ones that we made for that machine, big ones, and we used to send men and ladies down, and they would take the two ends and seam them on the machine.
Oh, right.
They'd sew them, used to do it in about 2 days. 3 of them, I'd do them a year.
Oh, right. Oh, much better.
But it was not so much the fact, when a paper, those days, I'm going back in those days, if that paper mill, paper machine stopped, that was £1,000 an hour it was costing them every time they had to change the phosphor bronze. £1,000 an hour. So they said like a few thousand. Still do that, and I think they still do them to this day. They go to Australia and do them in Australia.
Really?
I believe so. That basically is, you know, it's a conveyor belt really for the.
And is that quite porous then?
It's a woven. Oh yeah, it's a woven fabric, and there's different weave depending on the type of paper they make. The coarser the wire, the coarser the paper. The finer the wire, the finer the paper. When you go like to a paper mill like Stirling Stubbins, which is making tissue.
Oh,
yeah. You know, it's very, very fast machines. Pretty, really fast machines. You know, you used to do different paper mills. I went quite a number of paper mills, made different papers, you know. But again, there, number of paper mills that shut. I should think 60% of the mills that was going, paper mills, but was going 40 years ago, don't exist anymore.
Do we import a lot of paper, or is it being cut out of this?
We do. We do. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I would think around the Bury area there'd be probably 7, at least 7 or 8 paper mills. I think it's down to about 3.
Really?
And that's this different areas. The same to Aberdeen. There used to be a lot of paper mills around Aberdeen. Certain areas where you found paper mills, you know. Kent was another paper mill area, quite a few paper mills in the Kent area. South Wales, they seem to collect in certain, this area was a known.
And you would send your wires to all of these factories, I presume, would you?
There at Stubbins, they used to send wires all over the world. All over the world. It was a quite, they had, even to Japan there, and they still did one machine they do in Japan. It's a big one, it's a big, it's a dye shower. And I believe they still do it. And it's a big, expensive wire. And they still do that one for Japan. They used to do quite a lot of trade with Japan.
Really?
And,
how long ago would they have started trading with Japan?
Well, when they started, I mean, taken from when I was there, oh, I'd say 15 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was there, you know, the,
right.
as a manager that did the trading with Japan.
You retired when?
Oh, in 1989. But they did quite a bit of trade, and Poland, we used to do quite a lot of trade with Poland. Again, they used to send men and ladies to Poland to seam the wire on the machine itself. Swiecie, that was the name of the place there. Poland was very poor. Very poor. The people who went out there, they could have sold their clothes off their back. You know. Imagine if you take the seaman department, as it was known, as it is still known, there used to be, I don't know, probably about 50 people involved in that situation when I went, first went in there. There were ladies on two shifts, you know. There are now, I should think, I'm only guessing, but I should think like 24. That's automation. I'm still here, simplifying things. It's a very expensive product, and it's very. How can I put it? Competition is very, very keen. You know, it's hard. Because there's so many few paper mills now that, and really, it's the big paper machines that make it better.
Right.
And we haven't a lot of big paper machines in this country. You know, you probably count it with one hand not in this country.
Mm.
In America, Sweden, places like Norway, they got the big machines, you know, big paper machines. So I've done it. Probably the highest, I had a struggle.
Mm.
These were all little offshoots from that trade, you know. And, one of the things, like, if you had any big waste pieces, if you had a greenhouse, for instance, get a. No, sometimes it might be a big hen piece, no good, you know. Throw it over your greenhouse. You didn't have to, you know, when you whitewash your greenhouse when it gets too hot.
Oh, right.
Just throw that up.
Yeah.
When it comes, you just take it off again. It never rots, you see.
Right.
Never doesn't rot at all. And that's what I used to do years ago. The parks in Rumsbottom, I supplied them with quite a lot of pieces. Like, they sew them together and throw them off, you know, and they used to turn the whitewash in the greenhouses, you know. It was all sorts of little sidelines they had. Basically from the waste product in that sense, you know, it's
Was there a lot of waste in fact from that?
There was quite a bit of waste, you know,
mm-hmm.
quite a bit of waste. You see, you did the weaving and then when it was woven you had to have it inspected. Check the ladies there who checked it for faults, put any faults. And then it went on to the heat setting where you stretched it, heat set it, and that had a certain procedure to go on, but you know, it sometimes would take as long as 8 hours sometimes to go on the big piece, you know, and then that would stand for so many days. then it would pick up the seed. But you were working in millimetre. And then two ends come together like that. You've got to within about 2 millimetres with that width either side to be successful. But like in weaving, you develop a crimp, you know, you get where you're weaving going like that, you get a crimp. And the better that crimp is, the better it'll seam clicking when it's seamed. See, all the seaming they do is make it endless, but they have automated machines now to do it. It's going on all the time, and it's from when it's seamed, it goes back onto the setter, and again it has heat to. There's all the technical words like monocles and all the linking up together, you know, so that you do that, you stretch it, you make it so it's right to size, then you cut it and seal it to width, you know, then you have irons or you put plastic round on some of them, dependent, you know, seal edges, and then it's inspected by quality control continually, called the quality control there, final inspection, and then it's back put into a case, wooden case or a cardboard one, depending on which they use, marked up and ready for dispatch.
Has the processes changed very much over the years? Except it changed from cotton to synthetic, didn't you?
That was a big, because it needed a totally different approach in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
It was cleaner. Very much cleaner.
Mm.
So with cotton you had what they call fly and fluff and seedlings, you know, all, it was very, very well with synthetic. That did away with all that, you know. Although you had two different types of synthetic. You had the filament type, which is what you find in now, you know, that's the filament type, or the staple type, which is, you know, like the length of the wool on the sheep back is the length of the staple you get in wool.
Right.
And totally you could extend that.
Forever.
Yeah. When we used synthetic, you could extend that staple, so it made a stronger staple.
Yeah.
You know, it's. It's, I suppose, the advancement in that sense, you know.
You didn't actually make the terralene thread, I think.
No, we used to. On the staple terralene, they used to card it, spin it, double it, and everything on the staple. On wires, you didn't use the staple. It was all synthetic. All synthetic you used, you know, in that sense. You didn't use any. The doubling situation, that this is. With the other factories, that all we were left with at Stubbins was the warping, the weaving, and the finishing, which was the setting, seaming, and this, you know, packing. And of course, the numbers diminished. I think, as I say, when I first started there was over 500. When I finished, I think there was 124, you know, in that mill. So it just showed that there is. We did have. You know, I did have some. There was some fun, you know. I remember once going into the Lundy Park, you know, where what they call the cutting area, where especially where they did just the cutting. And I could look at this and I could see these marks, you know. These marks come from, you know, and across them. And I weighed it all up and I thought I could see what. So I went to one of the chappies. I said, who won? What they'd done, they marked it out for a five-a-side football. They'd been playing football. So they had it all to clear up and clean up. So I said, no, all them marks. We'll see them tomorrow. So the night, they were on night. You know, you didn't get. Problems on night sometimes, you know. I suppose the sense that although there was a supervisor there, that unless you did just keep your eye open, down, you get a little bit relaxed in that sense. I can just turn that off. Anyway, anything else you want, just...
Did safety procedures in the factory alter a lot over the time?
Oh, yes, yes. Safety, they developed, they had a safety officer who came, you know, you check a certain procedure to wear earmuffs with you're in the weaving section. In each setting, you had to be very careful. There were certain rules and regulations because you were dealing with intense heat, you know, because you'd easily burn yourself, you know. They had sprays available for that. So safety was very paramount there, and they did, I must admit, the company did. They used to have a safety committee who met once a month, and they used to, any difficulties, problems came up, and they were sorted out by it, and there was never any, not really, chances taken, you know. Everything was...
Were there many accidents in the earlier days, or not?
Pardon?
Were there many accidents in the earlier days, or was it always the same?
Well, I didn't see him, but while I was there, a man had his arm ripped off on one of the loons, and that was through sweeping his loom while it was running.
Oh, really?
The arm brushed up.
Yeah.
The arm went in and it tore his hand.
Yeah.
He lost his arm with that gentleman, and but he, like, once you were right, he got a job in the office, like in the time office, as you might say. He worked in the time office, you know. Another chap here, he broke his back with a gantry fell and hit him on the back, you know. He broke his back on that sense. I remember one or two broken arms. Odd times when the ladies were running around at Christmas.
That was the most dangerous time, wasn't
it? Yeah. One or two accidents used to tip, and that, again, when you talk about safety, that was one of the things through the safety that was stopped.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It was stopped. It was very, very quickly. It hadn't to be, because it was dangerous. You know, days gone by, they turned a blind eye. They were under the looms and over the looms, but that was stopped. There was no, you know, Mr. Landisbury, the running about was curtailed, not entirely but mostly. The running around the place was and the safety problem, it wasn't, you couldn't do it, and it was stopped. They did have a very strict safety. And if it was the fault, the people were selected from the shop floor to be on that safety committee. Right? The people, their own representatives was there on the shop floor to do them things.
I think you said your father used to work for Forest, did you?
Pardon?
I think you said your father.
Yeah, well, he was on the gardener. He was a gardener, isn't he? That was his...
So when would he have started?
Well, that's a good question. My eldest brother started there in 1921. My eldest sister started in 1923. My father, I would think, probably during the 1418 war, somewhere in that area, when he was involved in there. I'm just going back. Yeah, it would be during the 1418 war, I think, or towards the back end of the 1418 war, when my father worked there.
And did he work as a gardener all the time, or did he?
Yeah, well, he was a gardener. He didn't work there along as a gardener, because as I became starting to see life back, when he went being a caretaker at St Paul's Church.
Oh,
in school, he was a caretaker there for a number of years, but he didn't work a long while for it, didn't my father, not just sometime during the war, I think, that he worked there.
So a number of your family must have quit at the forest at one time or another then?
Yes. So the George did 50 years. The Sister Marie Lai did 44 years. I did 50 years. Another brother Roy did 40 years. I had two sisters did over 25 years. And I had two sisters who must have done... Three sisters who must have done about 10 years.
Really? Yeah? Were there many families where nearly everybody worked apart? Was that common?
Yeah, there was. There was... I know there was another family worked there. In fact, there are still one or two survivors of that family still work there. Not work there, still living, as I said. There is one man still living who's worked there. I don't know. I think he wouldn't be surprised during 50 years, but he was in the territory. And when Sir Richard Porritt was killed, he was there with him. He was an MP. I don't know whether you know about it. He was an MP. See, where the mill is, do you know the Cliff Nursing Home?
No, I don't.
That was Richard Porritt's home.
Oh, right, yes.
Below that one was a big house where his grandmother lived. His grandmother lived there. But originally, like, his grandmother lived there, and his father and mother, that was called Greenmount House, and his mother and father lived in the Cliff. And his mother and father moved to Green Yoversand, and the Cliff became this. And when he was 21, that was his 21st, they gave him the village, you see. The village of Strongstar belonged to the Porritt family.
Yeah.
And if you worked at the mill, you got a chance of getting a house in the village. See, that's how you got priority in the village. You got a job at the mill. So, and there was very cheap rent, too, in that sense. You know, the fence wasn't exorbitant. It was very cheap rent. I can remember even, you know, when we were children, I used to take my brother's tea sometimes. When he was on 2 to 10, I'd take his tea down.
Oh, yeah.
The cook and just take that down, and he'd be on the, he was a big loom wheel, I'd take that down. But outside the back, they used to have all the empty boxes as a yarn used to come in. All the empty boxes were stacked up there, and that was used by some of the men for riding to have a nip out round the back of the boxes and have a quick smoke.
Yeah.
We as children of the village, acorns, you know acorns. We used to collect acorns and hold them out.
Yeah.
Put a piece of straw through. And then we used to go collect the cigarette ends, open them up and fill them with tobacco. It was true, but that's what the mother things we did. And perfectly true is this. The man that was in charge of putting them boxes there, one or two of the girls in the village, don't forget, you had to be little, and they used to put the boxes so that they could go round you the corner.
Yeah,
it was, you know, it was, you used to have some amusing people there, and characters, some of them, in many ways, you know.
Yeah.
I have some.
What about
fire engine there? How far will this reach? There's some 40, I see.
Right.
When I started, there was Porritt Brothers in Austin, which was a Stubbings mill. There was Joseph Porritt, which was the Alan Shore mill. There was Samuel, which was Bamford mill. And there was the Spencers, which was at Mary Spencers Amalgamated with Porritts. It then became Porritts and Spencers.
Oh, yes.
That's how the Spencer family came to be involved.
Mm.
I could each I remember three of the poets being chairman of directors.
Mm-hmm.
And then the two of the Spencers. Horace.
And did you see much of them when they were directors?
Pardon?
Did you see a lot of them when they were directors?
Yes, you would guarantee they'd be come probably once a week, once a fortnight, they'd be going.
Uh-huh.
And they were very well informed.
Right.
I once remember Oliver, they always used to call him Mr. Oliver, Mr. Philip, Mr. Horace Spencer, Roland, Mr. Roland. And I think it was Oliver that once came in into the weaving shed. And the tattlers, the loom overlookers as they know, were sat at the bench. And he went down and he said, "That's where I like to see my overlookers sat there," he said. "Because if they sat there, all them looms are running, I hope." That was, you know, that was the tat he was. I remember he had trouble once with them, these doubling machines. They used to seize up, which would fire if you weren't careful. And it was just the makeup of the machine that were causing this. And he came in, but he was fully aware.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody put him well in the pitch, and he came to discuss what was happening and why it was happening. You know? And then they got it all changed, they had them changed. You know? It was like it was a matter of one composition and another, which didn't work, so they put different things on the spindles on the shafts so that they didn't do it. It was a very interesting funny story about the Dublin. There was one chappie, this was a doubler, and he had a glass eye. And when you wanted a smoke, because of the noise, you see, you had signals, so you used to say, "In other words, I'm going for smoke, keep your eye on the machine," you see,
right.
For smoke. With a little chappy there, oh, there, there's a little chappy coming, that could be anyway. And he's going for a smoke. So he shouts to this chappy with the one. So he took his glass eye out and put it. And that, initially when we went, they were only the, they only had the bulbs, you know, was lighted, they didn't have the strip lighting that they have today. And this little chap that I was telling you about, we used to change what we called the gear wheels at the end for the different twists we were putting in. And it was early one morning, only had the lights, no daylight, and a little keyway, and he lost it amongst all the fly, you know. And what does he do? Gets his cigarette lighter out and lights that. Whoosh! All the machine was a hacky. But that, you know, that's starting.